A socialist revolution in a backward country? With the 1905 revolution, there began an extended period of working class revolutionary upheaval around the world. That this had occurred in a backward country, barely emerged from serfdom, where industrial capitalism was not preceded by a bourgeois revolution or centuries of gradual capitalist development, raised important problems for the application of Marxism. Marx himself had argued that what made socialism, that is, workers' control of production and the state, full political democracy, full equality, what made this possible was the development of the productive forces to a sufficient degree to provide plenty for all for the first time in human history. Without this affluence, any attempt to establish socialism must fail, because, to quote Marx, without it, only want is made general, and with want, the struggle for necessities, and all the old crap would necessarily be reproduced. Why then did a revolution break out in Russia, and why was it a working class revolution? Russia was a backward country, and yet at the same time it was only part of the world economy, only one part of the capitalist world system. Lenin used the formulation, "The chain broke at its weakest link." The Great War of 1914-18 drew in a variety of countries at different stages of development, but demanded of them all the same level of participation. The more backward the country, the more the burden on that country's economy. Russia was first to leave the military field, but for this to happen, a dislocation of the Russian class structure would have to occur. Apart from the war, the higher the general forces of production, the tenser the competition on the world market, the sharper the antagonisms, the madder the race for armaments, the harder it becomes for the weaker participants. This is why the backward countries were the first to collapse. Thus, the war alone was not responsible, for even in times of peace, Russian society would have become the victim of the same contradictions which exploded in 1917. This explains why the Tsarist state suffered shipwreck, but not why a socialist revolution should succeed in a backward country. The breakdown of old feudal Russia should have led to a bourgeois revolution, as in France 1789, rather than into a socialist state. But the development of nations did not repeat itself mechanically. One faction of the Russian revolutionary movement, the Mensheviks, they argue that capitalism inevitably follows feudalism, that the bourgeoisie must be the new ruling class after the Tsarist aristocracy. From this, they argued that the task of the revolutionary socialists and the working class was to encourage the bourgeoisie to seize power. This position led the Mensheviks to support the bourgeoisie, even in opposition to the working class. A second view, held by Lenin and the Bolsheviks until April 1917, believed that the bourgeoisie would not seize power from the Tsarist aristocracy, but that the workers and peasants would have to do the job for them. That is, a workers' and peasants' dictatorship would establish capitalism and complete the bourgeois democratic revolution, and thus create conditions for the modern workers' revolution at a later date. Leon Trotsky alone believed that the revolution would have to be led by the working class in alliance with the peasantry, and that it would have to proceed to the creation of a workers' state. To repeat ourselves, history does not mechanically repeat itself, for different stages of civilization approach and intermingle with one another in the life of the one and the same country. In other words, there is a reciprocal influencing of backward and progressive countries. There, in the case of Russia, the pressure of the progressive countries on this extremely backward one. The backward countries must catch up with the progressive ones by borrowing their technology and science. This produces a development which is both combined and uneven. At the beginning of the 20th century, industry occupied a very small place in Russia compared with agriculture. The city bowed to the country, the worker bowed to the peasant. Overall, this meant a low productivity of national labour. In 1914, Russia had a productivity rate 8 to 10 times lower than in the United States. In what exactly did this combined development consist? Almost without highways, Russia began to build railways. Without having gone through the European artisan and manufacturing stage, Russia passed directly to mechanized production. To leap over the intermediate stages is the way of backward countries. Peasant agriculture often remained at the level of the 17th century. Russian industry, however, at least in its type, if it's not its scope, reached the technical level of the progressive countries. For example, the gigantic enterprise with over 100 workers each employed in the US less than 18% of the industrial workers, whereas in Russia it was over 41%. This is not to suggest that Russia was not backward, but it does show the dialectical components that could produce a socialist revolution in backward Russia. This same contradictory character was seen in the class struggle of Russia. Faced with the necessity of keeping pace with the West, the Tsarist government encouraged foreign investment, and the financial capital of Europe industrialized the Russian economy at a rapid rate from about 1880 on. The Russian bourgeoisie, which depended on the Russian state and on foreign capital, particularly British and French, was in no position to initiate a struggle against absolutism and the landed aristocracy. Such industry as existed assumed a large-scale character and an anti-popular character. The foreign stockholders, however, lived outside the country. The workers, on the other hand, were Russian. Against a numerically weak Russian bourgeoisie with no national roots, there stood confronting it a relatively strong, concentrated proletariat or working class, with strong roots in the people and with a high level of class consciousness. They had not years of parliamentary rule and conservative social democracy to spread social and political conservatism. By the late 1890s, huge mass strikes, both political and economic, were taking place, and revolutionary parties were in the process of formation. Nevertheless, the young and energetic working class still constituted a minority of the nation, approximately 25 to 30% of the people. The peasants were about 70% of the people. The reserves of the revolution were in the peasantry, still living in half-serfdom. This was the subsoil of the revolution, for the old feudal system became doubly intolerable under the conditions of the new capitalist exploitation. The peasant communal areas amounted to 196 million acres. And yet 30,000 large landowners, averaging 2,800 acres each, owned a total of 9.8 million acres, as much as 10 million peasants. But a peasant revolt is one of the elements of a bourgeois revolution, and not at all of a proletarian revolution. A class that was not opposed to private ownership of the means of production, but sought it against the large landowners. This was so in the past, but the peasant revolts, particularly from August 1917, did not drive the bourgeoisie forward as they had in France 1789, but backwards into the hands of reaction, dependent as it was on the Russian state and on foreign landholders. The peasants, backward and ignorant, isolated from the centres of power, production and culture, turned to the workers. Had the bourgeoisie been able to meet the peasants' demands, the workers would not have been able to achieve power in 1917. But the Russian bourgeoisie, a cowardly Johnny-come-lately, dared not lift a hand against feudal property. The power to change society therefore became the priority of the workers. For the Soviets, or workers' councils, to come, it was necessary for two different historical factors to come into existence and to collaborate. That is, a peasant war, a movement characteristic of the dawn of bourgeois development, and a working class, a class which announces the decline of bourgeois society. This was the combined character of the Russian Revolution. The peasant, although in revolt, is unable, because of his social situation, to give conscious expression to his indignation. He needs a leader, and he found one in the person of the proletariat. The second great reserve of the workers was the presence of the oppressed nationalities, who were largely peasants. The Tsarist state had grown enormously, subjugating the very backward areas, basing itself on them, in order to stifle the more developed nationalities of the West. To the great Russians, some 70 million, were added some 90 million of other races. The ruling nationality that governed Russia was only 43% of the population, while the 50% who made up the various nationalities were at varying levels of legal and economic deprivation. The Russian liberal, as seen in men like Kerensky, is either the agrarian or peasant question. In either the agrarian or peasant question, was not willing to go beyond a certain amelioration of the regime of oppression and violence. The democratic government of Melnikov and Kerensky, reflecting the interests of the Russian bourgeoisie and bureaucracy, hastened to impress on the nationalities the firm idea, you will obtain what you want only by force. The Bolsheviks' pledge of self-determination was upheld. It won the confidence of the oppressed peoples, though this was later violated by the Stalinist regime. They, like the Russian peasant, turned against the official democrats, the bourgeoisie, liberal and social democrats. They strengthened the proletariat and poured into the stream of the October upheaval. Prior to the 20th century, there were a variety of approaches amongst revolutionaries as to the need to destroy the Tsarist regime. The populists, who later split into two wings, the Lavarists and People's Will, had this in common. They believed Russia would not pass through a capitalist stage as did Western Europe, but that socialism could be reached through organisation of the peasantry. They relied on political terror and assassinations and against the Tsarist forces. Lenin, in his The Development of Capitalism in Russia, produced in 1897, proved beyond doubt that Russia would pass through the capitalist stage and would not be different to Europe. Accordingly, said Lenin, to ignore the industrial growth of the 1880s and 1890s would be a disastrous mistake, for it ignored the rapid growth of the working class, who had power way and beyond their size. At the commencement of the 20th century, the Social Democratic Party of Russia was founded, and at its second Congress held in London in 1903, at which various groupings were represented, a split took place, which was later to assume great historical significance. The break took place on the question of who could become a member of the Social Democratic Party. Lenin maintained that only those who devoted their lives to the revolutionary movement, those who could look on their work as a profession, subject to discipline from a central body, professional revolutionaries, only these people were to be entitled to membership. Equally eminent Marxists, on the other side, considered that membership should be open to all who professed belief in the labour movement. When the vote was taken, Lenin gained the majority, and as the minority refused to accept the decision, the conference split into two sections. Lenin's group was termed Bolshevik, similar to the Russian word of majority, and Plekhanov's group Menshevik, similar to the Russian word minority. We should note that Lenin's concept of the party was quite different to the monolithic bureaucratic instrument of control as it developed under Stalin. Self-criticism and internal democracy were part of the vital internal life of the party. When the party divided on the question of the October 1917 insurrection, men who opposed the insurrection, like Kamenev and Zinoviev, were not only not expelled, but were elected to the Central Committee of the party. Even Lenin, on several occasions, found himself in the minority. The operating basis of Lenin's party was democratic centralism, which combined the fullest internal freedom to discuss, coupled with complete unity of action. The party life was based on it being part of the working class, organised separately, but having no interest outside the needs of the class and the class struggle. The 1905 Revolution. In 1904, Russia declared war on Japan, and by August 1905 was forced to sign peace terms as a beaten power. The war revealed all the rottenness of the feudal aristocracy. Before its end, the country bordered on revolution, the bourgeoisie putting forward demands for a limited monarchy and a legislative assembly. Soviets, that is, councils of workers and peasants' deputies, were set up for the first time, not by the Bolsheviks, but by the workers themselves. The Social Democrats, Marxists, worked through the Soviets for support of the demands of the bourgeoisie, at the same time recognising that should the bourgeoisie be called on to complete their revolution, they would undoubtedly repeat history by going over to the side of the counter-revolution. The Social Democrats hoped through the Soviets to carry the revolution through to its finality and so pave the way for the later victory of the workers. On the other hand, the Social Revolutionaries, as they were named, based on the peasantry, refused to recognise the necessity for bourgeois society. Besides mass propaganda against the government, they resorted to revolutionary terrorism. The forces against Tsarism in 1905 were not strong enough to oppose it. The Tsarist government limped on until caught up in the 1914 war. Lenin said this, "For a revolution to take place, it is not enough that the lower orders do not wish to live in the old way. It is also necessary that the upper classes should be unable to live in the old way." End of quote. By early 1917, these conditions had been met in Russia. The Tsar had entered into a system of military alliances with the democratic republican governments of the French Empire and the constitutional monarchy of the British Empire against the German and Austrian empires. Inevitably, this alliance and its counterpart on the German-Austrian-Turkish side led to war. The war, which started in August 1914, was, in Lenin's words, quote, "a bourgeois, imperialist and dynastic war, a struggle for markets and for the freedom to beat foreign countries, a war to deceive, disunite and slaughter the working peoples of all countries by setting the wage slaves of one nation against those of another so as to benefit the capitalist bosses." End of quote. It was also a war that made unprecedented demands on the economies of the warring countries. The Russian economy was too weak to bear the burden. I'm quoting from Trotsky here. "The lack of munitions, the small number of actories for their production, the sparseness of the railway lines soon translated the backwardness of Russia into the familiar language of defeat. About 15 million men were mobilized. About 5.5 million were counted as killed, wounded or captured. Approximately 2.5 million killed." End of quote. In the cities, food shortages, shortages of clothing, of fuel, of all the necessities of life grew worse and worse for the poor. The rich, glutted with war profits, feasted, while cold, hungry workers slaved away for 10, 12 or 14 hours a day. The February Revolution. In the factories and the army, the influence of the illegal socialist organisations, mainly Bolsheviks, began to grow rapidly. Yet even they did not understand how rotten the regime had become, how easily it could be overthrown. The initiative came from the women textile workers of Petrograd in 1917. The 23rd of February 1917 was International Women's Day. The Social Democratic circles had intended meetings, speeches, leaflets, records Trotsky in his History of the Russian Revolution. It had not occurred to anybody that it might become the first day of the revolution. Not a single organisation called for strikes on that day. End of quote. The women demanded bread from the authorities, which was like demanding milk from a he-goat, wrote Trotsky. The Bolsheviks, expecting a quick defeat, reluctantly led the metal workers out on strike. On the 23rd of February 1917, over 90,000 workers went on strike. There was no violence, as the Tsarist officials were afraid that the infantry wouldn't obey orders to shoot the workers, because by 1917, the Tsarist army was almost as disaffected as the workers. By the third day, there was 250,000 workers on the streets. The soldiers were coming over to the workers, and on the 29th of February, the Tsar abdicated. But who was in power? The workers of Petrograd and the soldiers of the garrison had made the revolution. A Petrograd Soviet of workers' deputies sprung up at once, and soon workers' Soviets, soldiers' Soviets, and later peasant Soviets emerged all over Russia. In the first days after the fall of the Tsar, effective power was in their hands. But the leadership of all the important Soviets was predominantly in the hands of the Mensheviks and representatives of the peasants' parties, the Social Revolutionaries. For them, the object of the revolution was a democratic capitalist republic. Russia, they said, was not ripe for socialism. As the workers' representatives are in fact in power, they must hand power back to the liberal representatives of capitalism. A provisional government came into being patched together from members of the Duma, a fake parliament set up after 1905. The government had no other real support, and for the time this was enough. The provisional government was headed by the Tsarist nobleman, Prince Lvov. These bourgeois liberals were concerned to restore army order and in the factories, and even to restore the Tsar, though not the discredited Nicholas. They also stood for the continuation of the war, as well as for the submission of Poles, Finns, Baltic and Central Asian people to the royal rule of Mother Russia. There was talk of limited home rule for these peoples, but as with much of the provisional government's talk and that of its so-called socialist supporters, it was a question of waiting for the election to a constituent assembly. When will it be elected? Later on. The Mensheviks increasingly adopted the provisional government's policies. Lenin and Trotsky were in exile, and Stalin, who was editor of Pravda, wrote in March that the Bolshevik attitude was, quote, "Our slogan must be to bring pressure to bear on the provisional government in order to compel them to make peace." Lenin, in his Letters from Afar, rebukes this, stating, "To turn to this government with the proposal of conducting peace is equivalent to preaching morality to the keeper of a brothel." The road to October. In April 1917, Lenin arrived in Russia, and in a speech he declared, "No support whatsoever to the provisional government." Lenin argued at a Bolshevik conference for overthrowing the provisional government. "All power to the Soviets, a revolutionary peace policy, socialist construction at home and international revolution abroad." Lenin had the majority opposed to him within the Bolsheviks, and they argued that pressure should be put on the provisional government to compel them to complete the bourgeois democratic revolution. Lenin threatened to leave the party if his view was not supported, and this won the day. Lenin's view was a change from his earlier views, and was a move nearer to the views advocated by Trotsky in his work Permanent Revolution, published in 1905-7. The question of every revolution is state power. But what advanced in this revolution was a situation of dual power. To quote Lenin, "Alongside the provisional government, the government of the bourgeoisie, another government has risen. The Soviets of workers' and soldiers' deputies, a power based directly on revolutionary seizure, on the direct initiative of the people from below, and not on a law enacted by a centralized state power. The power is of the same type as the Paris Commune of 1871. End of quote. The Soviets were capable of running production, transport and communications, and they represented the real power that could replace the entire capitalist state machinery. But they were dominated by the Mensheviks, that is, Social Democrats, who stood for a capitalist republic, and whose policies would therefore mean the end of the Soviets. The provisional government told the British and French governments that they would not make a separate peace, and so mass demonstrations of over 30,000 soldiers resulted. Only the socialist leaders of the Soviet were able to persuade the soldiers to disperse, and the government begged the Mensheviks and the social revolutionary leaders to join the cabinet, as they had influence over the workers. This they did, and the socialist revolutionary's man Kerensky, as Minister for War, was the main driving force of the government. At first, Kerensky launched a successful offensive against the Germans, but it was doomed. The miserable armies continued to starve and die, while all over the country the railways were breaking down, food lessening, factories closing, speculators flourished as foodstuffs and fuel were secretly sent out of the country to Sweden. A prominent capitalist, Lezhnev, said this, quote, "Starvation and defeat may bring the Russian people to their senses. Revolution is a sickness. Sooner or later, the foreign powers must intervene as one would intervene to cure a sick child." End of quote. It was people like this that in July produced fabricated evidence that Lenin and the Bolsheviks were German agents. During June, although the Soviets still had Menshevik majorities, demonstrations in Petrograd carried predominantly Bolshevik slogans. By July, even more formidable demonstrations demanding all power to the Soviets led to a near insurrection in Petrograd. The Bolsheviks tried to contain the spontaneous outburst, because they knew that although the government could be beaten in Petrograd, Russia as a whole was not yet ready. This line was unpopular with many Bolshevik supporters, but once the insurrection began, it was the Bolsheviks who assumed the leaderships. The uprising was put down, a certain demoralisation set in, and a growth in support for anarchist groups. The provisional government seized its opportunity and arrested Trotsky, while Lenin escaped to Finland. The government was again reorganised with a socialist minority, that is, the Mensheviks and the Social Revolutionaries, again with Kerensky as Prime Minister. The effect was short-lived. Soldiers continued to desert, and the military advance turned to retreat. Peasants were seizing the land, and the economic situation continued to deteriorate. By September, the power of the Bolsheviks had almost reached that of the government. The Bolsheviks were now a majority in the Soviets, and governmental decrees were often vetoed by the Soviets. A Tsarist general, General Kornilov, proceeded to march on Petrograd, with some at least of the ministers in league with him. Some Bolsheviks said that there was now a need to support Kerensky's government against Kornilov. Lenin and Trotsky said, yes, we must certainly fight Kornilov, but it would be wrong to support Kerensky. Lenin's policy prevailed, and the Soviets marched against Kornilov with separate ideas and slogans than that of the provisional government. And when Kornilov was beaten, the Soviets were ready to challenge the government. The government then proposed a democratic conference on October the 7th for the purpose of setting up a parliament. This was an attempt to reconcile the Soviets to its power, which many Bolsheviks still supported. They argued that the revolution should and must be led from the Soviets to the establishment of bourgeois parliamentarianism, and that the participation was necessary to complete the democratic revolution. The Bolsheviks, in view of Lenin's insistence, withdrew on October the 10th, 1917, and on October the 16th, the Soviets set up a military revolutionary committee, headed by Trotsky, which became the organ of insurrection. Amidst rumours of another right-wing attempt at a coup, soldiers and workers took over Petrograd on October the 25th, or November the 7th as in our modern calendar, under the direction of Trotsky. Once the Military Revolutionary Committee had arrested the ministers and taken the winter palaces, they handed governmental authority over to the All-Russian Congress of Soviets, then meeting in Petrograd. The Menshevik members walked out, as did the right-wing Social Revolutionaries. The first Soviet government was set up by the Congress, which had a large Bolshevik majority. And at that conference, Lenin spoke, quote, "In Russia, the immense majority of the peasantry has said, enough of this game with the capitalists. We shall march with the workers. They will understand that their salvation is with the workers. We shall set up workers' control of industry. We are beginning to build the socialist society." Lenin's forceful tactics brought rapid support for the Bolshevik party.